KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Cloudy this evening, becoming mostly cloudy overnight, the low in the mid-30s. It's going to be clear and sunny tomorrow, the high in the mid-40s.
I've tried very hard, and I think I hope I've succeeded in choosing works that I wanted to write that were like an adventure.
When I was first diagnosed, the idea of taking medications and the possibility that that might flatten my creativity was terrifying.
I believe tonight our state has taken another step forward, and we have elected a forward-looking governor, and I fully intend to be that governor in the next state of Washington.
We're going to find out more about Elliot Carter, the composer who passed away. Ellen Forney is going to talk about her bipolar disorder. She's an artist, graphic novelist. And you heard Jay Inslee there talking about the campaign. We're going to start with that. Still no winner in the governor's race. Charter school measure as well, also too close to call. Matt Barreto is a professor of political science at the University of Washington. He's director of the Washington Institute for the Study of Ethnicity and Race, director of the Washington Poll. Matt Barreto, thanks for talking to us again.
Sure, thanks, Steve.
So I want to play you something that Rob McKenna has put out to his supporters. He was talking about where we were at in the counting of ballots as of late last night.
We saw in our own internal polling, we saw in external polls done by King 5, for example, that he enjoyed that advantage among early voters, but that advantage disappeared among later voters. And with almost half the ballots left to count, we believe that my advantage among later voters is what is ultimately going to carry me to victory in this election.
So, Matt Barreto, is Rob McKenna, who's looking at early returns and then later returns, later ballots, is he right to hold off at this point, even though he's a little bit behind Jay Inslee?
No, I think that there's no evidence whatsoever, now that we have 2 days of ballots that have come in, that McKenna's making up any ground. On election night, Inslee was winning by 49,000. This morning when I woke up and looked at the data, Inslee was winning by 49,000. So there's been an additional day of ballots counted, these so-called late deciders, and the margin has not been reduced at all. And we have to remember that the most ballots that are outstanding for any county in the entire state are from King County. Some of these other counties in central and eastern Washington have already reported 65 or 70% of all their votes, and King County is far, far below that. So the math is just not in favor of Rob McKenna. I don't see any evidence at all that he can overcome this 49,000 lead that Inslee has.
Now, the Secretary of State's office last night said they had about 700 and, well, three-quarters of a million ballots to count. Seattle Times this morning said maybe a little over a million might be coming in total, so 750,000 plus another 300,000 or so. Could it be that those ballots are, that they're widespread enough, that there could be massive changes? What kind of percentage would he need to gain in the incoming ballots in order to overtake Inslee at this point?
Well, he would have to be leading in those ballots, right? Because he's currently losing by 49,000. So he would have to make up 49,000 votes. So he would have to be running ahead of Inslee, not just getting closer, but he'd have to be running ahead of Inslee in the remaining ballots. And the remaining ballots are not a proportionate reflection of the state. They don't represent all counties equally. Out of those 750,000 ballots that might yet to be counted, something as many as 400,000 might be just from King County alone. So it might be half or even over half. If that's the case, that half of the ballots are coming from the place that you're losing, 62 to 38, you have no chance to win, because those King County ballots, in my opinion, and we've looked at every single county, what percentage they've reported, how many they have left to count, and what the margins are. The King County ballots are going to contribute another 60 to 80,000 vote margin for Inslee. So instead of being down 49,000, he'll be down 109,000. So even if he makes up votes in Spokane and Yakima and Pierce counties, he's not going to be able to make up over 100,000 votes. And I think ultimately Inslee's margin may go up by a point.
Matt Barreto is a professor of political science at the UW. associate professor and also director of the Washington poll. Charter schools is a little bit ahead, and referendum 74 is ahead, though neither have been officially declared victors. Anything in the later returns on there that you think will could afford some shift in what the counts are now?
Yeah, I think referendum 74 is the most certain out of everything that's out there, even more certain than the governor's election. There is no chance that referendum 74 is going to lose, so I think everyone can be quite confident that that is passed. The charter schools is a lot trickier, and again, we're trying to read the patterns that are in each county and project those patterns forward with some wiggle room. The reason charter schools is much trickier is that in King County, the votes were evenly split. It was 51-49, and so it's not as though we know, oh, there's a lot more votes to count in King County, and they're breaking 2-1 in this direction. That was the case on referendum 74. On 1240, on charter schools, it's not necessarily the case. And so while there are a few more no votes here in King County, it's not clear that those would be enough to overwhelm the lead that charter schools have. So it does have a small lead, and it looks like that might hold, but that's the one that has the biggest question mark because so many counties were evenly divided on that it's really hard to say. When you see some counties are just really going in one direction or another, it makes it very easy to project what the results will be, and we don't have that on 1240.
So, Matt, I was just wondering, what have you learned about the electorate, the people who turned out in Washington State, from these returns, starting with election night and up to today? Anything jump out at you?
Well, I think that, number one, it seems that we had very good turnout here in Washington State. Every time I look at the projections, they say there's more ballots yet to be counted than they thought. And that would indicate that that high voter engagement and high voter turnout, I think, was driven by some of these really interesting and groundbreaking initiatives we had. Not only was there a very close and exciting governor's race, but we had Referendum 74 on marriage equality and Initiative 502 on marijuana. And these are things that don't come around every day. So I think that Washington State will be, at the end, one of the states with the highest vote totals, voter turnout rates. At the same time, that perhaps the state voted heavily Democratic on the president, the Senate, and ultimately the governor, you had Initiative 1185 to make it harder for the legislature to raise revenues and increase taxes pass again. I think this is the third time now. And the charter schools amendment is just going down to the wire. It's really, really close. And so, again, as we find every year, there's a little bit of conflicted opinions here in the data, in the returns that are coming in. It's not as though it was an overwhelming 20-point sweep for the Democratic side here in Washington State in those issues. There were some more moderate and conservative issues that did seem to prevail here in Washington State.
All right, Matt, I appreciate you taking the time.
Okay, Steve, anytime.
That was Matt Barreto. He's Associate Professor of Political Science, Director of the Washington Institute for the Study of Ethnicity and Race, and Director of the Washington Poll, all through the University of Washington. Democrats held on to their majority in Olympia, ending Republican hopes of taking control of the state Senate. The election saw some hard-fought races. Two veteran legislators appear to be losing their seats. For a look at what's happening in Olympia, Chris Griegel joins us, Washington State news editor for the Associated Press. Chris, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
You know, let's talk about just a few of the uncertain races at this point, and then let's broaden it out a little bit. So there was the race that Cheryl Flug was part of, and then she moved away. She was appointed by the governor, and then she endorsed the Democrat. What's happening in that race right now?
You know, it looks like the Democrat, Mark Mullett, is likely going to defeat the Republican, Brad Toft. He's leading by about 7 or 8 points. So it looks like that will be a Democratic switch for the party and big disappointment for the Republican.
Was it because of Flug's endorsement of Mullett, or was it because this is a changing district?
I think it's a combination of both. You know, anytime someone running for office gets an endorsement, especially in the state legislative seat where there's, you know, a lot of people don't have a lot of information, that certainly helps. But it's also, you know, part of the, I think it's reflective of the fact that Republicans are having a harder and harder time being successful in King County.
In these outer burbs. Any anger from Republicans? I know there was some lingering anger about what Cheryl Flug had done. How's it stand today?
I think there's still quite a bit of anger. I think that from the Republican perspective, they think they got hoodwinked. They think that Governor Gregoire basically made a deal with Representative Pflugk, and they're not happy about it.
She gave her a job, right? Correct. She's got a job. I forget what her job is.
She got a job in state government, and after that, she endorsed the Democrat. And so, you know, the Republicans were not happy, and they made their displeasure known.
Who knew that the governor was playing that kind of politics?
Yeah.
And in the Vancouver area, Don Benton might be in trouble. I remember when Don Benton was a very prominent member of the Republican caucus.
You know, I think that's one that everybody's keeping an eye on, and we're a little surprised by. Like you said, Don Benton's one of the most outspoken members of the state legislature, tremendous name recognition for a state legislator. And right now, he's in the fight of his life against Tim Probst. You know, they're separated by just about 100 votes, so that one could go either way. But I think people are thinking that Benton might just end up on the losing side of that.
Did the Democrats put a lot of money into that seat, or did something happen to Benton?
I think, you know, the Democrats certainly targeted that race. That's another area that I think the demographics have shifted somewhat. But I think that's just one of those races where every now and then an incumbent's number is up, and this just might be the year that Don Benton loses. But again, that's very, very close, so that one could go either way.
And an incumbent's number may be up in Camano Island, where Mary Margaret Haugen, who's been a leader in transportation and other issues, is losing to State Representative Barbara Bailey. What happened there?
You know, I think people always thought that Mary Margaret Haugen might be a little bit vulnerable, and I think she faced a tough challenger in a sitting state representative, so someone with a built-in constituency, and that was just always going to be a hard race for Senator Haugen, and it's looking like she's not going to be able to pull it out.
Now, I read two interpretations of what happened there. One from Bailey. Bailey says it's about her conservative politics and her effort to put more control on government spending. What do you hear?
You know, I think that's a part of it, but I also think that you know, for so many state legislative races, the incumbents don't face serious challengers, the incumbents tend to win, and this is a race where Representative Bailey had already been elected in that area and had a built-in constituency and was able to run a strong campaign. And sometimes when a state legislative incumbent faces a serious challenger, especially one who already holds elective office, it can be tough.
Any evidence that that Haugen's support for the referendum 74 or for the gay marriage passage in the legislature had an impact in what is Camano Island, a more conservative, more evangelical area?
You know, that might have played a part in it, but you know, I'm not so sure that was the decisive factor. I think that, you know, that was perhaps an issue, but I think the issue in this race really was that she was running against another elected official who had her own constituency, and so that I think at that point it just becomes, you know, who can get their voters to the polls, and she faced someone who had already been elected by the people before, so it was not going to be a cakewalk for Mary Margaret Haugen, and I think the Democrats going into this thought that she was probably the most vulnerable member of their caucus.
In the first legislative district, McAuliffe and McCravey, now that looks like maybe because of the money that was spent by the supporters and opponents of charter schools, that may have had some influence, that may have played a part in the race. What do you think?
I think that's probably true. I mean, I think, you know, there are so many state legislative races that don't get a lot of attention, and if you, when you get a hot-button issue like charter schools and money starts coming in, that's bound to have an effect.
So overall, what impact is this going to have on the way the legislature operates this next session?
You know, that's what everybody's trying to figure out. On the face of it, it's, you know, the Democrats will retain control either with a 27-22 or a 26-23 majority. The big question is you know, the perennial one for state Senate Democrats, whether they have practical control. They still have a few conservative members in their caucus, and if they swing towards the Republicans on a few issues, the Democrats lose effective control of the chamber, and you saw that last session when there was that coup over the budget. So we're going to kind of go back to a stasis point where the Democrats will nominally be in charge, but they're going to be worried about holding on to some of the more conservative members of the caucus.
They have a few less members of that roadkill caucus, don't they?
They do, but I think that there's always concerns that the minority Republicans who aren't that much in the minority might dangle a few bobbles in front of Democrats who might hop over the aisle on an issue by issue basis.
And whether it's a Governor Inslee or Governor McKenna, what's the biggest problem confronting the legislature? Is it education spending?
Absolutely. I think they've got to come up with at least $1 billion. For new education money, and while the economy is improving, it's not improving. To the point where they're suddenly going to have another extra $1 billion lying around, and whether it Jay Inslee or Rob McKenna moves into the governor's mansion, they both said that they don't want to raise taxes, and I don't think any of the serious number crunchers in the legislature think that can happen. They've got to find new revenue.
Yeah, that's what the governor says as well. All right, Chris, I appreciate you taking the time bringing us up to date.
Thank you very much.
Chris Griegel is Washington State news editor for the Associated Press. We'll be tracking what happens to the legislature with him and other folks in the months ahead. This is Weekday.
It's 9:21. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. I'm Andy Hurst. This month, local photographer Matika Wilbur will set out to photograph the members of 562 Indian tribes across the U.S. She'll tell us more about her project coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Dance Theater of Harlem, performing the world premiere of Far But Close and Contested Space, choreographed by Donald Byrd, November 16th and 17th at the Moore Theater. Tickets available at stgpresents.org.
We have partly sunny skies in Seattle, 43 degrees right now in the University District. We're expecting a high today of 48, partly sunny skies all day. Partly cloudy this evening, becoming mostly cloudy overnight, the low in the mid-30s. It's going to be clear and sunny tomorrow, but still fairly cold. Tomorrow's high in the mid-40s.
This November, Matika Wilbur, a local photographer, will set out to photograph members of the 562 tribes in the United States. She's a member of the Tulalip tribe, a professional photographer whose work focuses on identity and culture, cultural duality of Native people in America. Thank you for being here.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm so excited to be here. I love this station.
Oh, that's great. Then that's even more reason for you to be here. That's great. This is an amazing project. Describe what you're going to try to, what you are going to do.
Well, my project 562 is, well, my goal is to photograph every tribe in the United States to create a comprehensive collection of character study portraits culminating into an exhibition, publication, lecture, and website. And, I really would like to renew the way that people think of Native America.
How do you think people think of Native America now?
Well, I just think that it's time for an updated version. You know, the last time somebody has done a project of this nature, focusing on all of the tribes, it has been nearly a century.
So I'm going to come back to that photographer and that century. But before I do, when did you start taking pictures? And when did you decide that you were going to be taking pictures of your family, your friends, your relatives?
Well, that's a good question. It's been a long road. I started first by going to the Rocky Mountain School of Photography, and then I went to Brooks Institute of Photography, and I initially thought that I wanted to be a fashion photographer or a celebrity photographer. So I interned in Los Angeles and went there, and then about 6 months into that, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to be selling things for the rest of my life. What am I doing? So I took a job and went to South America and started photographing indigenous people in South America. And I had been living in the Sacred Valley in Peru for a number of months. And I had a dream with my grandmother, Laura, who passed on when I was about 13 years old. And It's the only dream I've ever actually had with her. And she said, what are you doing photographing these Indians when you haven't even photographed your own? Go home. and photograph your people. And so I did, and that's when We Are One People was born, and then from that.
One of the first exhibits you did, one of the first portfolios you did, yeah.
Yeah, and, which was shown at the Seattle Art Museum and the Royal British Columbia Museum, but I didn't initially aspire to be a documentary photographer of Indian people. It just sort of picked me.
And picked you.
Yeah.
That's what dreams will do.
Yeah.
All right. So what do you want it to look like at the end? What's your vision for the entire catalog?
Well, I really would like to create a dynamic portrait of contemporary Native people in Indian country, you know, from the Pawnee entrepreneur who owns a restaurant who's selling Indian tacos to the politician who's lobbying for our, you know, sovereignty, the youth who are experiencing cultural duality, the elders, the culture bearers, and really sort of bring to the forefront, you know, this is who we are now, and this is how we've evolved as a people.
Why is that important today? Why is that necessary, do you think?
I think it's necessary that people realize that we survived. You know, and I think the stereotype that I've experienced quite often is that we didn't, or that we're not here anymore. Not so much in the Northwest, because, you know, there's a very dynamic exchange happening here. But in other places, for instance, like when I was in Germany and people would ask to touch my hair or something.
Really?
Because they'd want to be, you know, they've always wanted to be blessed by an Indian princess, that type of thing. So I feel like, in a way, it's necessary.
So that noble savage notion running strong in some places still.
The diminishing race.
Yeah. So we talked to Tim Egan about Edward Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
And Egan's argument was, because he wrote a book about Edward Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
Egan's argument was that the rap on Curtis was that he was capturing Indians as museum pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But Egan's argument about Curtis and about what Curtis said was that he was getting a snapshot in time to establish an image and a sense of Native people 100 years. This was 100 years ago. Not that they were vanishing or diminishing, but that they, here's where they were today. But you disagree with that somewhat. You see Curtis in a different light.
I wouldn't say that I disagree. I would say that I would reference a quote that he said, that Curtis said right after he was commissioned by J.P. Morgan in 1906, where he said, you know, we must capture the diminishing race at once before all is lost. And so I think if that is the perspective, that I have to go out and I have to photograph all of these people before they're all gone, then that's a different sort of conception than my standpoint.
Well, I get that. Was Curtis right to be afraid, though, 100 years ago?
I'll let the viewer decide that.
Well, I mean, in the end, he wasn't. I mean, it was one of the things in Egan's book was the notion that, you know, Curtis disappeared. Curtis's popularity disappeared, but the population of Native peoples went from, I can't remember what it was in the 1900s, was it 200,000?
Mm-hmm.
It was really low.
It was at its lowest point.
Right. And now today, you know, that's not the case. Not a diminished or a vanished peoples at all,
mm-mm,
but a people that are, you know, part and parcel of what's around us. But I'll ask it again. At that point, there was this fear, right? There was this fear or desire, depending on who was putting it forward, that this would be a diminished or a vanished race. Here especially, right, in Seattle and how people were treated.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're looking at is the baseline 100 years later, right?
Exactly.
And how important that is.
And how we've evolved. You know, I think quite often we're often stereotyped and grouped with leathers and feathers and teepees. I mean, you go out on Halloween, have a look at the way that people associate Native people.
Go look at high school mascots.
Have a look at the high school I went to, the Braves, the Redskins.
Where was that?
LeConner High School.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
How did that feel?
I don't think that I was able to really understand all of that then. I think...
Today? How does it look?
Well,
do not want to get in trouble with your friends.
Well, no, I had an amazing question, yeah. I had an amazing experience growing up, really, because I grew up on the Swinomish tribe, and I didn't realize until I left the res how different of and how unique that experience really is until I moved to Santa Barbara. But every morning there was a bridge crossing. You know, we left our side, the Swinomish side, to cross the bridge to go to LeConnor, where I went to school, where the majority of the teachers were non-Indians. And so I think that regardless of whether or not I was able to put all of that together then, looking back on it now, I realize that there's some messaging there that goes on between the teachers and the students. And if you have a look at where the students always sit in the classroom, it's always in the back of the room, in the cheap seats, you know. And
you too?
Not anymore.
But then, not anymore.
Not anymore. But then. And so, you know, isn't it time that we change that?
Matika Wilbur is a member of the Tulalip tribe. So you were on the Swinomish Reservation, member of the Tulalip tribe?
My mom is Swinomish, Nancy Wilbur. And excuse me for not introducing myself properly. I'm from the Swinomish tribe. And my mom is Nancy Wilbur. My grandmother is Laura Wilbur. And I'm also from the Tulalip tribe. And my father is Kenny Joseph, and my grandmother is Loretta James. And that would be the traditional way of introducing myself in Indian country.
How are you going to introduce yourself in Indian country to the 562 tribes that you're going to visit? I mean, beyond what we just said, how are you going to tell them what you're doing?
Well, fortunately, we have this wonderful thing called the internet. So
they'll already know.
I have been doing a tremendous amount of outreach to tribes. Also, you know, Indian country is small, so I have a feeling that most places I go, I'll know people or have relatives or relations. And if I don't, my relatives or relations will have people to contact. So that, in a sense, is, you know, I'm fortunate to be a part of that community.
You're going to do every tribe, even the tribes that are not recognized by the federal government?
And that is a very, very sensitive issue. And, you know, the project title, 562, is also kind of sensitive. You know, when I started this project a number of years ago, that was the amount of federally recognized tribes. Since then, it's gone up to 566, and then back down to 565. So when you check that fact, that's always changing. And that is a representation of, you know, the complexity that's happening with tribal sovereignty.
Who lost their recognition from the federal government?
Oh, you know, I don't want to go into that, actually.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Are you going to photograph the other four?
Well, actually, I will also be photographing the state-recognized tribes as well. There's about 570, give or take a few, federally recognized tribes, and then another 400 or 500 state-recognized tribes. And then there's a number of places that don't have any recognition at all, such as, you know, where we are right now, mm-hmm. the Duwamish tribe mm-hmm. doesn't have federal recognition.
But they're there.
But they're very much here and very much a living and breathing culture. And my intention is not to be exclusive by any means. The number 562 is really just a jumping off point for me, because I think people deserve to know that there are that many nations still existing, coexisting in the United States.
What will be the difference in your portrayal of Swinomish people and Tulalip people? I mean, do you have some of those photographs already taken?
Mm-hmm.
Who will be representing, or what will we be seeing?
Well,
I guess I'm going to the question of the difference between Swinomish and Tulalip, mm-hmm. as well as the things they share.
Well, the Swinomish tribe is a smaller tribe. There's about 1,000 to 1,200 members versus Tulalip is a much larger tribe. So the other day I photographed my cousin Anna Cook, and we talked a little bit about cultural duality. She grew up in Mount Vernon, then just recently moved back to LeConnor, and just went on the paddle to Swinom, or the paddle to Squaxin Island. And, you know, she's sort of learning, reintegrating in a sense with her culture. And so I think it's a really interesting perspective. I'll also photograph, well, I've already photographed my brother, who's a tribal senator, and I've photographed elders from the Swinomish tribe, ones that have passed on, ones that are still here, ones that our spiritual leaders, cultural leaders, and you know, eventually when I showcase these images at the Tacoma Art Museum, there will be an editing process, but that's a number of years from now. So for now, I'm just attempting to create the most accurate depiction I can of what is happening right now in Indian country.
In looking at some of the pictures from the other works you've done, some people are in traditional garb, whatever that would mean, presenting themselves traditionally.
Regalia.
Thank mm-hmm. you. Some people are not. Who chooses? What are you looking for?
I let my subjects choose. Yeah, so, I invite people to come to a photo shoot, and a lot of times they'll say, "Well, what do I wear?" And I say, "Well, what would you like to wear?" You know, for instance, Harlan Sam came from the Upper Skagit tribe to have his photograph taken, and he brought a headdress with him. And, you know, headdresses aren't traditional for the Upper Skagit tribe. However, he had been in Yakima recently, and it was a gift that was given to him, and he loved it and wanted to wear it. So who am I to say to the chairman of a tribe, you can't wear that? No, that's just not my position. You know, my position is to do as my gift was given. My name, Matika, means the messenger. And so I really feel as though my position is to sort of translate messages.
How are you raising money?
Oh, raising money. Well, I'm super, super excited about my Kickstarter. I just had a successful Kickstarter campaign.
What were you looking for from Kickstarter?
My goal was $30,000, and we raised $35,000. And, you know, it was my first time doing a campaign like that. It was for 30 days from October 1st to November 1st. And, I mean, wow. I was so overwhelmed by people's generosity. It just really was such an overwhelming experience for me. So many people were writing about it on Facebook, and the response that I got from all of my people was just, it was amazing. And people's generosity is so humbling.
And, that's great. And then you have to do grant writing.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, $30,000 isn't enough for a 4-year project on the road. It's enough to get me started, and it's enough for me to go on the road for about the next 10 months and start creating the collection that I will then use to go to apply for larger fellowships and grants through larger foundations. So right now I'm waiting to hear if I'll receive a grant from an unnamed source.
Now, these are pretty amazing portraits you're doing. What's your camera? What kind of camera are you using?
Before we go into that, I just wanted to invite whoever's listening, if they're interested in the project, they can go to my website or the blog where they can donate if they would like to.
Which we have links to at kow.org. So yes, I was going to end with that.
Okay, but
MatikaWilber.com. But just real quick, what are you using for technology?
I'm using a Mamiya RZ67. It's a traditional medium format camera.
Oh, so it's a medium format camera.
6x7 film. And I'm...
Film?
Film. Yep. And I have an amazing printer that I'm working with who helps me. And doing everything as I go. I have I can develop at any sink. So I could make sure that I got it. And then proofing, I have a Canon 7D.
And you're starting. You're on the road now for this project.
Absolutely. I'm having a going away party on the 19th of this month, on Monday, at Hot Cakes in Ballard. If anybody would like to stop by, you're more than welcome to come.
Great.
And yeah, I'm on the road as soon as I get my war pony.
Your war pony? What's that?
War pony, my
Toyota.
Maybe Toyota Tundra. The debate goes on about what is the most appropriate mode of transportation. Is it a travel trailer? Is it an RV? Is it a van? Is it a Westfalia? And then also, I'm also seeking some corporate sponsorship for the war pony.
Hence,
we'll see how that goes.
Hence, it may be a Toyota or those others as well. All right. Matika Wilber is a member of the Tulalip and Swinomish tribe. She's a professional photographer. She works on identity, duality of Native people. She is setting out to photograph the members of 562 tribes in the United States of America. I hope we can track that with you as you make progress.
Oh, I would love that.
That would be very cool. You could send us some messages and feel free to record some interesting sounds.
Oh. Oh, absolutely.
All right. You're now charged. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
And you can find her work at a link from KUOW.org, MatikaWilbur.com. This is KUOW.
We have partly sunny skies in Seattle, 44 degrees right now in the University District. We're expecting a high today of 48. Forecast says partly sunny all day. It's going to be cloudy tonight, the low in the mid-30s, clear and cold tomorrow, the high in the mid-40s.
Support for KUOW comes from Walker's Renton Subaru, where Pacific Northwest adventures begin. New and used vehicle inventory and information online at RentonSubaru.com or at Exit 2 off 405 in Renton. Subaru. Think. Feel. Drive.
Every memory you think you have of the past?
The house you grew up in. Your first kiss.
It's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
That's this week on Radiolab.
And that comes your way tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 9:41. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Obstetrics. The UW Medicine Obstetrics program helps women have healthy pregnancies and healthy babies through its comprehensive family-based approach, including midwifery, lactation support, genetic counseling, or high-risk care. More information at uwmedicine.org/obstetrics.
A few minutes now remembering the composer Elliot Carter, the two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, passed away on Monday at age 103. What's his legacy? What was his contribution to music? Simon Woods is executive director of the Seattle Symphony. He joins us. Simon Woods, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Steve.
Can you tell me, just to start with, what relationship does and will the Seattle Symphony have with Elliot Carter's work?
Well, our music director, Ludovic Morlot, knew Elliot Carter from his days when Ludovic was assistant conductor at the Boston Symphony. And Carter always had a great relationship with the Boston Symphony. In fact, I was just reading the New York Times obituary, and I was reminded that one of his very, very early formative experiences was hearing the Boston Symphony play The Rite of Spring back in the 1920s, if you can believe it. So he had this long relationship with the Boston Symphony, and Ludovic met him in Boston about a decade ago and became friends with him. And after Ludovic became music director here in Seattle, he had the temerity to say, well, why don't you write a piece for the Seattle Symphony? And Carter said yes. So we have this wonderful short piece called Instances, which we're going to play at the beginning of next year.
That was the plan even before he had passed away.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it turns out now that it's Carter's last orchestral work. So it's quite a privilege for us.
You know, I was reading these quotes about Carter and his work, and I was taken by this one. So I know that some audiences didn't like his work. It was too something complex. But Carter said, as society evolves, people will have to become much cleverer and much sharper, and then they will like my music. Tell me about what that tells you about the man that he made that statement.
Well, I think he was uncompromising, and his music is very abstract, and you know, it's not the kind of music that you find your way into instantly. I often think about it as it's a bit like standing in front of a big abstract contemporary art canvas, something like a Rothko or something like that, where the more you look at it, the more you look into it, the more beauty you see. And I think Carter was very concerned with writing music of enormous integrity and enormous structural interest, but he was absolutely uninterested in its kind of immediate superficial impression. He was writing things from himself. He was really writing with a great sense of what he wanted to write, not what others wanted to hear.
I mean, it's amazing to think that he lived so long. He was somebody then who spanned the whole century and the change of classical music as it evolved, right? Was he a part of that?
Yeah, he was a part of it, and he was an extraordinarily influential figure who was... one of the paradoxes about Carter is that although his music is unbelievably difficult to play for musicians, I mean, it really pushes at the envelope of playability, he was kind of beloved by the musical community, partly because he was an endearing person, but also because his music is so rewarding. So he has always been part of the musical mainstream, and I think his influence will be around for many decades. And he's an extraordinary figure because he's writing music the whole way through the 20th century, while all sorts of other traditions came and go: modernism, postmodernism, popular culture, all these different traditions came and went, and Carter just went on like a kind of river, heading downstream, doing what he did with enormous integrity.
All right, we're going to go out with a little bit of this string quartet that he composed in 1950, Simon Woods. Anything that we should listen for to understand this composer?
Well, I think the first thing to say about it is it's not the sort of music that is you're going to get a tremendous amount of in a few seconds. It's something that you have to listen to again and again. The greatest compliment I can pay Carter is that normally when I hear one of his pieces, the first thing I want to do is hear it again, because it's that repeated listening that draws you in. So,
all right. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll come back to it again another time. Simon Woods, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Simon Woods helping us remember Elliot Carter, the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning composer who passed away. He's executive director of the Seattle Symphony. They'll be performing some of Carter's work in March. String Quartet from Elliot Carter. We have to listen to it again, and more of it. 16 years ago, award-winning cartoonist Ellen Forney was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. In her new graphic memoir, Marbles, Mania, Depression, Michelangelo and Me, Forney examines that period of her life. She talked with Marcy Silman as part of our Art of Our City installment about how she turned that time of her life into art. Marcy asked her about that original diagnosis.
I was seeing a therapist, but a social worker, for, I guess, maybe a few months. I was seeing her when I was feeling down. And then a few months later, I was getting more and more up. And she called it jazzed. I was calling it manic-y, which mm-hmm. was, again, you mm-hmm. know, a word that I had been using for a while. There again, I think that there was some unconscious or subconscious idea of maybe what was going on. And she referred me to a psychiatrist. And, I don't remember what I was thinking then when I went to the psychiatrist, what I thought she might say or why it was that I was going there. But I know it was pretty quickly, I think the second visit,
wow,
that she told me that I was bipolar, and I didn't believe it for a moment. And then we went through the symptoms together, and it just dawned on me as we went through it that was me.
The drawing of you, Ellen, in that state, you're literally starry-eyed. It's this happy sort of incandescent creature with these kind of spit curls.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you had little spit curls
time. I did.
And these, you draw yourself just... almost as if you're going to leap through the page.
Mm-hmm.
So as a reader, you get the sense of how you must have felt electric. at that time. Not in a bad way necessarily.
Well, I think as a cartoonist and in a graphic memoir, I had some tools that were very particular to comics. So in the different mood states, I used a different rendering style. So like you were just saying about when I was manic, it was very like starry and loopy and big and loose. And then when I moved into depression, the way that I depict that is a lot more stark. It's a lot more kind of heavy. And then, you know, I go through various ways that I was up and down and upset and confused or overwhelmed or happy, you know, and in different styles, including photographs of my sketchbooks. So just a way to kind of touch back in on that it's a real story and here's something archival.
You kept a journal, a sketchbook, and a written sort of set of lists because you were watching yourself a lot. That, I think, was an assignment from your psychiatrist, as well as maybe something you did yourself.
Yeah, that was both. I had a lot of material to, you know, refer to when I was doing Marbles. I had actually a stack of journals. So it was writing. It was just tons of writing about just what I needed to get out, and then drawings in those journals as well. And those clips of those, or little excerpts of those, are in Marbles as well. And then also sketchbooks. And I picked out some from when I was really depressed, just needed to get down some of those demons, I guess, onto paper. And then also some drawings from when I was manic and just loopy and just like whatever was coming down on the paper.
Maybe we should take a step back for listeners who don't really know what bipolar disorder is. Some people might know bipolar disorder under the term that we use to refer to it by, which is manic depression.
Although bipolar disorder is kind of the day. I asked in the process of doing this book, I had a psychiatrist that, not my own psychiatrist, that I was in touch with to run things by him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, so what is the usual dosage for this medication or things like that? And asked him, is there a difference between manic depression and bipolar disorder? And he said no, that it's just basically the style of the day. Like,
so now we call it bipolar disorder.
Exactly, yeah.
But essentially, it's a disorder that involves cycling between two states of being. One is sort of manic euphoria, and the other one is debilitating depression.
Right. Although really it manifests itself differently in different people. So, for example, for me, mania was really euphoric. At the same time, it was really this sense of being pulled and compelled, so it wasn't all just a joy. And for some people, it's being really irritable or really angry. So it's just, it's like a lot of energy. It's a lot of energy that we would experience as sort of beyond our control, right? And then depression would be kind of the same experience that's very common to a lot of people that have depression, even if they don't have bipolar disorder, which is feeling really, not just feeling really low, but feeling really low that doesn't feel attached to any sort of grieving. And it's this weird prickly low.
And I'm holding up the book, which of course nobody can see because this is radio, but I think that this particular full page illustration really says how I feel personally when I'm depressed, when I'm in a state like that, which is there's a lump, which is you, who finally manages to pull herself through a door. And that's it. That took everything that you had. And then you're back in
lying down on the couch under the blanket.
Did you draw this at the time or in retrospect when you're putting the book together?
I drew this in retrospect. And there again, just to point out the drawing style,
yes.
I used a really, really simple style there. So it's me, but it's just this general idea of what it was like. So for me, at different times, for other people, probably it's about the same amount of detail as like a restroom sign, right? So
yeah.
So that was a general experience of what I called cocooning. I think we all often, or many of us, have even names for these different mood states. It becomes this thing that almost feels outside of you. It's inside of you, but it surrounds you to that kind of degree that it becomes its own character in a way.
There's the whole way you feel. That's one big thread through the book. But another, which you latched onto, I think, almost immediately, or at least in this book, which is the connection between what you call your manic states, or those states of euphoria, and your artistic creativity.
Being an artist is so much a part of my core that when I was first diagnosed, the idea of taking medications and the possibility that that might flatten my creativity was terrifying. And so at that point, I decided that I was not going to take medications. It's one of the points in my book that I examine really throughout the entire right. book, what that has meant to me as an artist throughout all my mood states and different treatments. And that's why I bring in the different artists and writers through history that have had mood disorders and little bios of them, and then the studies that are about creativity, what it is, and correlating mood disorders and creativity, like I talk about in why it was important to me to keep my sketchbooks when I was depressed. It was a way to get this tangled, difficult to understand parts of me and sort of whirling around my head down on paper. And so this was like an enormous version of that, going through all of this onto paper.
Seeing the book and talking to you right now, it's tied to something that's in the book on a more personal level. Obviously, that notion of coming out with mm-hmm. bipolar disorder to people mm-hmm. that you knew, including your family, a big section about that, your friends, the reactions of your friends. This is coming out on a much more public scale than talking to your mother.
Right. Yeah. Yes, it is.
And so I wonder, in putting together that proposal, how scary is something like that? I mean, it's different than talking about sexuality. Or maybe it's not different. I don't know.
Well, it is. I think that sexuality is, in my experience, kind of a joy to put out there. And it's something that you can be, you know, like cheeky or brave. And it's a really different kind of brave, I guess. This is a different kind of brave.
Yeah.
When I was putting the book together, in particular in the beginning, I have to say I wasn't thinking nearly so much about what it was going to be like at the point where I'm at right now of putting the book out there. That sank in over the course of probably the penciling and inking. I mean, to a degree, when I was, you know, like mapping out the story and what is it that I'm comfortable sharing or at least can share, right? There were some things that, you know, I kept private, believe it or not. It's kind of a
there's a lot of
yes, I know. There's a lot of exposing myself, but in a way I think allowing yourself to be vulnerable that way and to just put it out there, it makes me feel stronger.
That's Ellen Forney. She talked with Marcy Soman for our Art of Our City. Ellen Forney is an award-winning cartoonist. She's been published by Fantagraphics, The Stranger. She recently put out a graphic memoir, Marbles, Mania, Depression, Michelangelo, and Me. This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
Weekday listener Barbara recorded her husband stirring a soup pot with a wooden spoon as he was making chicken stock. You can hear the burner heating up. You can hear him stirring. You can hear that wooden spoon bumping against the side of the pot. It's kind of interesting how a common action can sound so creepy, isn't it? Barbara said it reminded her of scary movies and scary noises that we tried to make during our Halloween show this year. We should have stirred some soup to make that scary sound effect. If you have an interesting sound, what are you hearing? record 30 seconds and send it to us, won't you, along with the story behind it, spooky or otherwise. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Stick around.
Stay tuned for NPR News coming up.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.